So that is The Adventures of Steve EV from 1990. Gosh, 30 years old. Doesn't seem like that to me. But anyway, Dirty Cash and Money Talks. So welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, who I hope we'll hear a bit more from this hour, and me, Tony Gosling. Face masks on buses. That's just for poor people, right? So also censorship of the US film The Truth About Vaccines, as Big Pharma try to shut down the debate over how safe and how well tested the vaccines really are. We played a clip from the documentary The Truth About Vaccines last week. More clips this week. And I keep emphasizing, we don't like in Britain, do we, the truth about this, the truth about that, because it sort of doesn't kind of work over here. That's for the American audience. But anyway, we're going to have a listen anyway. And Putin announces a new space race with space-based missile defense shield fit to defend Russia in a third world war. But hardly any reporting of that here in the UK. The Swedish ambassador to China is put on trial for trying to negotiate the release of a Hong Kong bookseller. Well, why would he be put on trial for that? We'll have a look at that one. And appointing judges, top military and intelligence officers, a network of Lord Lieutenants across the country, and Bristol's very own Society of Merchant Venturers by royal appointment. They are, of course, actually constituted under a royal charter. Don't be surprised if you don't know too much about the power of the British monarchy. We aren't supposed to. It's secret. But what some would argue is the biggest change in our spiritual and political life since the Norman invasion could be only 10 months away. There are rumours, very strong rumours, of course denied by the palace, that Prince Charles is due to take over the British and the Commonwealth monarchy from Queen Elizabeth II in April 2021, when she retires from public life. Charles has made it clear he's not staying out of politics, giving a speech today about the COVID-19 pandemic on the same day as it was announced face masks will become compulsory on public transport. And as head of the church, God would be out under Charles, and the self in prayer would be replaced by meditation, and resurrection by reincarnation, as a new blend of Hinduism, Buddhism and atheism would replace the focus on Christianity as the national faith. As such, he will be the only person in the UK, if he takes over as Prince Regent in April 2021, as officially above the law, because the monarch cannot be arrested. He cannot be forced to attend court, nor can he be arrested, charged, tried or imprisoned for what are criminal offences for everyone else. This is because, as head of the Church of England, a position dating from the 16th century reign of King Henry VIII, he's considered to be infallible, an inheritor of the divine right of kings. But Charles is not a defender of the faith. He's a self-confessed defender of faiths. He considers all religious beliefs of equal validity, which is incompatible with his mother's and supposedly preceding monarchs for the last 1,000 years, Christian beliefs. This dropping of the specific adherence to Christian law, the Ten Commandments, honoured in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, into one phrase, which is love thy neighbour, and expounded in the New Testament, may have serious legal consequences, not least in the coronation oath Charles would take before he could become Prince Regent. Precedent demands that all new monarchs defend the Christian religion and when crowned. So Prince Charles is planning to overturn hundreds of years of tradition. No wonder he's put so much time and money into public relations on TV. And we see him, don't we, all over the media recently, as well as, some might argue, ensuring all voices which might ruffle a smooth transition to his becoming the Prince Regent are discredited or silenced. Princes Andrew and Harry, for example, come to mind. So as the one Brit above the law, would he perform the role as a model citizen, as his mother supposedly has? Can we trust Charles not to abuse his role? Has he so far been respecting the law, or has he been breaking it? We look at the litany of death and crimes surrounding Prince Charles, particularly surrounding his Highgrove country home, just after over half an hour from Bristol, near Tetbury in Gloucestershire, as well as looking at the film Unlawful Killing. That's assassination to you and me, about his former wife and mum to William and Harry, Princess Diana. That's the film made by Keith Allen. So anyway, we'll be talking about that in a minute. But first of all, Martin, I think we should get stuck in with some of those stories this week. Particularly amazing to see that in the Russians announcing this in space, a missile defense shield. This is, I mean, you might expect the Russians to have some sort of missile defense shield against the one that NATO has been building in the Baltics. They've been building it in Romania, and they've also been building it in Poland. But the Russians have decided, rather than do exactly what NATO's doing, they're going to actually do one in space instead.
Well, the ABM treaty in the 1970s basically allowed both sides to have short-range missiles around their capitals to prevent a decapitation first strike, in theory. In practice, I think it's very difficult to see how a defensive shield could work. I mean, the Star Wars program of Reagan basically was a fantasy program. It's very difficult to stop incoming missiles. And the Russian strategic doctrine up to this point has always been that we're not even going to try and protect ourselves with something like that. There's no point. But if you fire any rockets in our direction, we're going to pulverize you. And that has always been Russian strategic doctrine. What I didn't pick up this week. I'll have to look it up. But what I did pick up this week is that Putin was talking to up to now, the Russian and Soviet doctrine has always been no first strike of nuclear weapons unless we are ourselves under attack. But what he said this week is a conventional attack which threatened the integrity of the state could in theory lead to a nuclear response.
How big is that as a change in Russian tactics?
Well, it's not that big a change, because a speech he made some years ago, he said, we're not going to use nuclear weapons first. And of course, this is in contrast to NATO, which has always claimed that it would use nuclear weapons first if it felt threatened. And they won't say under what circumstances they will or won't use them. It's what's called strategic ambiguity. And of course, it's very silly, because it means the other side are on a hair trigger. And any small accident can lead to a war, a nuclear war. And of course, he could argue that in a sense, it doesn't make that much difference, because you could keep saying that you're never going to use them first. And then you could use them first anyway, even though you've been saying that you wouldn't. You know, you can see that that's possible. It's feasible. I think ultimately, talk of strategic doctrines in relation to nuclear weapons are a bit abstract, because then they're not usable anyway, really. If they're used at all, it's going to be the end of all of us. Now, what was significant, what Putin said previously, was that if there is a nuclear attack on ourselves or any of our allies, we will respond with an all-out nuclear strike. Now, that was a clear line in the sand, for example, to the Israelis, saying, if you nuke Iran, we will nuke you. That's basically what it communicated. And of course, that is quite, that's obviously the nuclear fighting doctrine gets down to this whole thing. And they definitely war game this sort of thing. Is if, for example, the Iranians attack, the Israelis nuke Iran, would the Russians then nuke Israel, knowing that the Americans might nuke them? And also that the Israelis probably would try and nuke them back, because they've got 200 nuke warheads of their own. And of course, you could get into the idea that countries would basically negotiate with each other. You know, so New Delhi would take out Islamabad, and then the Pakistanis would take out a city on the other side. And you could have a nuclear war that went on for several days, with each side taking out other, basically bargaining about which cities were going to
dock. Isn't it more likely it would be much quicker than a few days?
Well, I think in actual fact, all of these kind of ways of fighting a nuclear war, and the Pentagon have been doing them for years, and people who have seen the film Dr. Strangelove from the 1960s, they've always thought in terms of fighting and winning a nuclear war. And in actual fact, it's irrational. And I think the Russian strategic doctrine up to now has been pretty solid and pretty thorough, which is, we've got these in case we're attacked with nuclear weapons. That's why we've got them. And of course, if they didn't have them, they might have been attacked. There definitely was it definitely was suggested that they should be attacked when they didn't have nuclear weapons.
Martin, look, you use a very interesting word there, irrational. But I mean, it's quite easy to see that quite a lot of US policy around the world is irrational. It doesn't seem to be benefiting the US population or the US at all.
Well, the US population, let's face it, are not really the issue. What the military industrial complex in the US has its own means and motivations, which have nothing to do necessarily with protecting their own population.
So we can't rely on them to be rational, can we?
Well, no, we can't. And of course, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union in 1942, he was not being rational. He couldn't win. It was a gamble and he lost. But that doesn't mean he didn't do it. It was quite irrational to send everybody to concentration camps and kill them all off. That was not a rational policy, but he did it. And of course, there's no guarantee that any human actor is going to behave rationally, even their own interests or anybody else's. You can't presume it.
Okay. And also, I mean, you're talking about the nuclear stuff. We've been looking at the apparent testing evidence emerging over the last 3 or 4 years that the Nazis definitely did test a nuclear weapon in October 1944. Even more evidence I've seen this week of people that witnessed that atomic test and descriptions of it. Like a giant flower cloud, they called it, the first people that ever saw a nuclear bomb going off in October 1944 on one of the islands, apparently, which was occupied. Well, it was a German island in the Baltic, I imagine, near Denmark somewhere. But also, Martin, you know, we were talking about Operation Gladio over the years. I was seeing that Martin Bormann actually played quite an important role at the end of the war in the werewolf units. These are the units which would, and it's when the policies changed, because Hitler instituted a Nero policy, which was a slash and burn policy. Actually, Bormann, who was negotiating, it now seems clear, with the Allies, ended that, saying, well, we won't burn the factories, we won't destroy the bridges. And that sort of thing. And the werewolves were partly to do with that, because the idea was, well, if we can cooperate a bit with the Allies, we can sneak some of our people behind the lines. And as they advance, then these units will still be able to operate. And of course, Bormann himself was very much planning for operating after the so-called end of the war at the end of April, beginning of May 1945.
Well, what happened, it seems clear, is that the Nazi intelligence structure, virtually in its entirety, was absorbed into what became NATO. And that, of course, if you think about it, explains an awful lot about the criminality of NATO from the 1940s onwards, including assassinations of political leaders in Belgium and elsewhere. Basically, the Communist Party was quite strong, left-wing socialists quite strong in Belgium and in France and in Italy. And the fascist intelligence structure working with the British and the Americans then basically created both left and right-wing terrorism as a means of preventing democratic change in Western Europe. There's a whole literature about this now, and most people who've looked into it can see that that's what's been going on.
There were even bomb attacks by these werewolf units as late as October 1946. So, for example, in Stuttgart, there was a unit still operating, which was living in the woods, a bit like the partisans, and sabotaging the occupying forces. And there is some hint that Martin Bormann, when he came over to the Nuremberg trials, anonymously sitting in the public gallery, as is detailed in the John Ainsworth Davis, Christopher Crichton's book, Op JB, that he, in that same visit to Germany in 1946, he also visited some of these units. So that might explain, as they used Bormann as a way to meet some of these Nazi units, the werewolf units, and then they used that as a way to basically round them up. So he was a kind of lure the werewolf units in, so that MI6 and the CIC, the American equivalent, could detect who these people were who were doing these bomb attacks. And then, but anyway, so I don't know if you'd heard that. Is that feasible, do you think?
Well, I think it's, if you think about it, it's quite strange that there wasn't a kind of armed resistance to Allied occupation. Very strange. I mean, in the Soviet sector, it's probably because they just basically pretty ruthlessly rooted out what the opposition was going to be. But in the West, you'd have thought that they could easily. But if you've done a deal and then these people are basically given a whole new life. You're just going to go back to civilian life. You're going to carry on being a terrorist, but you're going to be working for the government. And Vincenzo Vincinguero, who was such a foot soldier, he was a gladiator, because, of course, the gladiators became the World Wars became the gladiators. And he was interviewed in Frankovich's film, it was on BBC Two. And he said, well, weren't you worried that the state was going to come and basically get you? And he said, well, the state doesn't prosecute the state. It was the state which had given me the instructions to carry out the bombings.
Well, amazing. And I'd just like to plug the book I've been reading about this. It's called The Last Nazis, SS Werewolf Guerrilla Resistance in Europe, 1944 to 1947. And they've got in there quite a lot of detail, but also they've got extracts from the manual, the Werewolf Manual, which you can still see, which explains how to do things like, for example, I mean, this is the idea, of course, of Operation Gladio to a certain extent as well. And they were doing attacks on police stations, the werewolves were. And it says Winke für Jagdenheiten. So it's basically a werewolf's guerrilla manual. But Martin, how does this all link up to Operation Gladio? And what was Gladio and when did it take place?
Well, the justification for Gladio was that if the Soviets invaded Western Europe, there would need to be a kind of a resistance, and just similar to the resistance that had worked during the war, you know, the SOE and so on. And that was the justification for it. But they then went off and created a whole parallel network, including arms dumps, access to munitions and weapons and so on. And then, of course, the Soviets never did invade. They probably never had any intention of invading. Most Soviet policy was essentially defensive. But they did intervene by becoming terrorists. So, for example, the head of the Belgian Communist Party was assassinated. And people want to, it's still out there on the internet. The films about Gladio that were made by Frankovich and were shown on the Time Watch series on BBC Two in the 1990s. And there's a lot of information in there. And of course, more's come to light since. And you've also got the book that was written by Daniela Ganser, who's a Swiss academic.
Oh, yeah, that's NATO's Secret Armies,
which, and again, that's, you know, that was written some years ago now. More information comes to light all the time. Andreotti, the former head of, Prime Minister of Italy, admitted that all of this had gone on. And we're talking about killing of hundreds of people. And, of course, it raises a very big question mark over so-called Islamist terrorism, because we know for a fact that the international brigades of Wahhabi and Salafi terrorists who went to fight in Afghanistan against the Soviets were all orchestrated and trained by our own special forces and intelligence services.
Operation Cyclone,
the biggest.
We're nearly up to the present day. You've done quite a nice job there, giving a bit of a history of this NATO terrorism, picking up exactly and precisely where the Nazi terrorists laid off. But we've also seen this week, haven't we, Israeli airstrikes pounding northern Syria. Martin, it does seem as if whilst all this coronavirus news coverage is going on, the fact that Israel is trying to start a war with Syria or seems to think that it can just bomb anyone it wants in Syria with impunity has been ignored.
Well, that's been ongoing, as you know. And in general, the Syrians have not responded other than by trying to shoot down what's incoming, because they know if they fire back at the Israelis, then you're then into a full-on war scenario. And of course, we're on the brink of war. The beginning of this year, if you remember, was the assassination of Soleimani by Trump, which was actually throwing down the gauntlet. And, this may well be that the virus, we're talking the first hour about conspiracy theories and so on, it's quite possible that this virus has been created as a bioweapon. Because we know that the US have got lots of biowelfare laboratories. DARPA have got them all over the world. And that they basically tried to crash the Chinese economy. They failed because the Chinese are sufficiently well prepared for a bio attack to deal with it. And, of course, the blowback of it coming into the US, what that does is it gives them an excuse to bail out the financial services sector, because it was going down the drain in September. The repo market was being the Fed was intervening in the repo market in September. Now, if the financial services sector, if the banks had collapsed again and they just said, we're going to have to bail the banks out again, then people would have gone nuts and say, well, look, we did this 10 years ago. Why are we doing this again? What's going on? But of course, they've got a cover story. It's coronavirus. That's why we're doing it. And of course, that's, you know, my copper's hunch is that that's really what we're looking at. But you've got to be logical about it.
Martin, there's also a fascinating article I came across recently, which is saying that actually the origins of the US bioweapons program were taken from Nazi Germany, a whole load of Nazi scientists.
And from Japan. And of course, in the 1950s, during the Korean War, they were bombarding the North Korean population with various pathogens. They've clearly got no reason not to do that. I mean, they don't see it as in any way the sort of thing that they wouldn't do. And they've done it. I mean, Cuba has constantly been complaining that these various diseases have been introduced into their livestock herds and so on. And it's, you know, the in theory, nobody is supposed to be developing biological weapons.
The DARPA
program, Porton Down, you see, the Russian equivalent of Porton Down was dismantled in the 1990s during the Yeltsin era, because the Russians said, well, we're at peace now. We don't need any of this, are we? So they dismantled it. But we didn't dismantle ours. Why not?
Martin, looking at the whole China thing, I mean, that was involved in the Soleimani assassination, the Iranian general who was assassinated, because the Iranian parliament pointed out just after that in a closed session that actually there was a whole load of deals that had been done with the Chinese to sort of help with Iraq's infrastructure. Iraq's infrastructure had been done by the Chinese. And so this was seen as the Americans were threatening. Trump apparently phoned up the Iraqi prime minister and threatened his life, saying, don't do any deals with the Chinese.
Yes. I mean, it wasn't reported in the mainstream media in the West, but it is out there if people want to check it. Soleimani was he was actually going from Baghdad to talk to about the possibility. He went to Baghdad to talk about the possibility of a rapprochement with the Saudis. Now, that would be very, very unwelcome to A, the Israelis, and therefore B, Trump, because he does what the Israelis want. So they probably were the main people behind that assassination.
Well, we've covered Craig Murray is now apparently going to have to face a trial here. He's a former British ambassador who had a mind of his own. And now in Sweden, the ex-ambassador Lindstedt is on trial for risking, inverted commas, security for the first time in modern Swedish history. An ex-ambassador has gone on trial and faces a possible jail term. Anna Lindstedt is accused of going beyond her remit by holding unauthorized talks with foreign power to gain the release of a Chinese-born Swedish citizen. Guy Minhai, a Hong Kong bookseller, was later jailed by China for illegally providing intelligence overseas. Prosecutors said Mrs. Lindstedt had put relations with China at risk. She'd acted in violation of Swedish foreign policy by arranging any negotiations, he told the court on Friday. The former ambassador's defense lawyer told the court she denied the charges. So she's been trying to negotiate, but apparently this has caused all sorts of trouble. She now faces going to jail, just a little bit, you know, maybe in a parallel situation here with Craig Murray. But it looks as if governments are getting very, very much more controlling, as you would expect them to be in a run-up to war.
Well, yes. I mean, the danger of war is palpable. We missed a bullet when the Iranian ships carrying oil to Venezuela were not interdicted. And of course, there's a British ship involved in that. So we would have been at war with Venezuela and Iran, just like that, if they tried to stop those ships going
in. So, I mean, are they prepared to actually fight, or is all this all just saber rattling?
Well, the problem with saber rattling is ultimately you have to carry through on your threats, or your threats don't mean anything. What happened with the assassination of Soleimani is that the Iranians, as you know, basically had to do a lot of thinking to do about what their response was going to be. And they ultimately fired several missiles into a US air base, having given them a warning to get undercover because we're going to shoot at you. And Trump at that point, he's basically been bloviating. Well, if anybody attacks us, we're going to waste them, blah, blah, blah. But he didn't respond. He couldn't respond. because he knew that if he did respond, then the Iranians were going to take out all of the U.S. assets surrounding, because they're surrounded.
Isn't this called the art of the deal that Trump is kind of into brinkmanship?
Well, he is into brinkmanship, which when you're dealing with nuclear weapons and World War III, is not really a terribly good look.
Anyway, but something positive is that the troops have been sent home from the District of Columbia, from Washington, D.C. It looks like that thing might be calming down now and pressure being put on Trump not to use the military.
Well, that's because there's no constitutional basis for it. This is why he was talking about the Insurrection Act of 1807, which has never been used. Because it actually breaches the Constitution to use military, and you know there are various conventions that
they have. And the civil libertarians over in the US are saying that actually what we've seen for the first time, they say, the first time in the US that ever has been seen completely unidentified law enforcement officers. So a whole load of police. Paramilitary style police appearing on the streets with no identification whatsoever and their faces covered.
Well, you can be sure that they have got it's a continuity of government plan, a plan for martial law in the US. It's been there for ages, and it was, there's a creeping, I mean, after 9/11, the Patriot Act created a whole completely new set of circumstances. Yeah, the possibility of civil war leading to military dictatorship in the US or general war on the planet is definitely there. And the COVID crisis is, in a sense, part of the ongoing preparations to destroy the world we live in.
What's the motive for that?
Well, the military-industrial complex has got its own dynamic. I mean, Curtis LeMay and Lemnitzer were planning to, if you watch them, the people who play them in the film 13 Days in May, which is about the Cuban Missile Crisis, they were quite prepared to blow everything up. That's why Kennedy basically had to get out from under their control, because they were quite capable.
Well, they were worried about the communism, weren't they?
Well, I know, but I mean, you know, better read than dead. They were basically irrational in their attitude towards nuclear weapons. They always have been. And it's the same crew that were planning to blow up airliners in
Operation
Boston.
You couldn't make it up, because there was that Strategic Air Command guy, General Power. He's definitely worth having a look at too. Anyway, so we're going to go on to look at the Truth About Vaccines film now. I don't like the title of the film. I find it quite irritating, but the actual film itself is absolutely fascinating. We're going to hear now about the role that Google has been playing. Obviously, they own YouTube. There's been an immense amount of censorship on YouTube of dissenting voices of experts around the world just being simply removed, taken down off of YouTube, even after millions of views. Professional doctors giving a view which is generally speaking critical of the hardest of the hard lockdowns, saying that there should be relaxations of various sorts being removed. So let's have a listen now to a clip from The Truth About Vaccines with Robert Kennedy speaking, who's a Democrat supporting anti-vaccination campaigner in the US, who backs up or everything what he says with absolutely hard facts, particularly to do with the Bill Gates Foundation carrying out deadly vaccine trials in parts of the world where lots of poor people, the developing world particularly, where it's very difficult for people to organise to fight back against what seems to be a legitimate vaccine program, which ends up spreading the disease and killing people.
Well, you know, there's been a huge global drive by the vaccine industry to mandate vaccines and end public debate. So we've had a long-term censorship on network television, which receives, and you know, in the press, which receives about almost $10 billion a year from the vaccine companies, and you know, for advertising, etc. And so that allows them also to dictate content. So we've never been able to debate or discuss this issue in the mainstream press, but we were able to go to the social media. But in the last year, we've been completely shut down in social media. Google has become a vaccine company. Google now has a partnership with Glaxo. Google is making vaccines, and they're partnering with Merck. And they've completely shut down all discussion, what they call vaccine misinformation, that is not misinformation. It's information that is critical of a medical product, of a pharmaceutical product. Facebook has shut us down, Pinterest, MailChimp, all of the major social media platforms have shut us down. And then there's also been a push to mandate vaccines. This is a product that they know they could not sell in a marketplace, so they have to mandate them. And they know that they can't win the debate, so they have to censor it.
So that's the key issues there. They know that they can't sell it in the marketplace, so they have to mandate it. And they know they can't win the debate, so they have to censor it, Martin.
Yeah, powerful statements. And of course, it's RFK Jr., his father was assassinated 50 years ago this week or whatever. I was reading about this. And of course, that's, you know, never been resolved. That's the kind of state the United States is. And I'm agnostic on vaccines. But the vaccine companies, the biotech companies, are clearly criminal. I don't think there's any doubt about that. They've got their own vested interests at work. There may even be more sinister.
But Martin, the fines that are imposed on these companies are peanuts compared to the money they're making.
Well, they've passed legislation, have they not, that people cannot sue for vaccine damage. And certainly if there's any COVID vaccine comes forward, and of course there's some doubt about whether you can develop a vaccine, stuff like this, but let's say they bring one forward, one of the things they will demand before they produce it is that nobody can sue if it causes any negative consequences. So there's a real possibility that they're going to come up with some cockamamie vaccine, which possibly doesn't even work, and then force people to have to take it.
This mandating actually reminds me of Mark Purdy and the BSE scandal, which he died after investigating it. He's an organic farmer. He actually came from the Purdy gun family, and he had lots of cattle who were mandated. He was mandated as an organic farmer, and he fought it to treat them with this FOSMET, organophosphate pesticide, that was poured along the spine of the cow and went right into the body of the cow. And he was completely adamant that this is what was causing BSE. And that was a mandatory product. He never actually treated his cows with it, but he fought the Ministry of Agriculture for many years. Anyway, so that's the sort of same sort of mandatory stuff that farmers were doing, and it now seems to be maybe even happening to people. But let's have another listen now to The Truth About Vaccines, a second clip from that film. I mean, I'm particularly interested in it because I see when I put a clip up on YouTube from that film, immediately it gets taken down, apparently by the copyright owners. But I'm in touch with the copyright owners, and they say, well, it wasn't us that did it. So obviously this is someone spoofing, pretending to be The Truth About Vaccines producers and authors, just simply winging it and trying to get stuff taken down off the internet they don't agree with. Let's have a listen to the key issues now in that film.
If you do not speak, if you are afraid to speak, then you are a part of the problem, and you will never, ever forgive yourself if we lose this. And you watch your children getting sick because they're being lined up to be injected with things they have no control over. And you're getting Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and dying earlier and sicker on more and more drugs because you can't stop the injections the government is giving you. When you're laying in your bed and that's happening, you say to yourself, you know what? I probably should have said something. Let's not find ourselves in that position. We're being called upon right now to stand up for what this country believes in, why we're here, and what this world should be celebrating, which is pure, complete, total liberty and freedom.
I'm from University of Virginia, and in the 1770s, Thomas Jefferson and the people who wrote the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence were in part upset because the Church of England said, if you don't worship at the Church of England, you don't go to school. Well, that, you know, now in 2020, if you don't worship at the Church of Big Pharma, you don't go to school. You don't participate in our freedoms. If that's not at the basic level of the Constitution and everything our country stands on, I just don't know what is.
We have to protest. It is absolutely imperative that at every level we protest and we refuse. We simply have to refuse in numbers that are sufficient to terrify the politicians into doing the right thing. It has to be the case that we say to the politicians, you work for us, not the pharmaceutical companies, and we are going to determine whether you are elected or not. And we will elect only those people who will look after our interests and not those of the pharmaceutical industry. Because without that, then we are facing a very, very bleak future. And people need to wake up to that. They need to put everything else to one side. The environment isn't going to kill us in anything like the same time frame that vaccines are going to kill us. Vaccines, if we have one in two children by 2032, which is the predicted numbers based upon the CDC's own data, one in two children with autism, then you have an environment where you either have autism or you look after someone with autism. There is no economy. The environment's irrelevant. Public policy, foreign policy, everything is irrelevant. There's nothing. There's no standing army. There's no police force. There's no economy. There's nothing. And so that's what we face. And people, it's so enormous that people really can't even conceptualize where we are. But I've watched this emerge over the last 20, 30 years. And I know it to be true, that this is what we face. And autism is just a small part of it. Small part of the damage done. And they have 270 new vaccines in the pipeline. So if you're happy with 72 doses by age 18, then are you going to be happy when it's in the hundreds? I doubt it very much.
So that's Andrew Wakefield. He's not a doctor anymore. He was booted out. But he does seem to make a very, very convincing case. We don't obviously see him making that case. And I said last week on the show, it'd be very interesting to see him do a discussion with Bill Gates about this whole vaccination program, because we're now seeing a situation, Martin, emerging where on British public transport, everyone will have to wear a mask or else face a fine. Of course, this is just for poorer people who don't have cars or don't use cars so much. And that's going to happen until a vaccine is found. Now, I know you think that a vaccine may not be found, but this all does start to sound like it's using coercion, not quite necessarily mandating like they've done in Germany where people your kids don't go to school if they don't get vaccinated. And there are some countries where rolling fines take place. So you get a monthly fine for not vaccinating your kid. And the face masks are a large part of this, I think, in order to persuade people, particularly poor people, to take this vaccination.
Well, as you said, we haven't actually got a vaccination yet. So anybody's saying that it's got to be mandatory or whatever. As you saw, I pointed out to you that the opposition in Nigeria had complained that Gates was bribing the current government to make any COVID-19 vaccine mandatory. And as they said, we haven't got a vaccine yet. So you've got to separate out logically various aspects of this. There are vaccines, there's mandatory vaccines, and there are face masks. And they're three different things. I've been vaccinated for various things, and I'm sure you have, Tony. I was vaccinated for polio and various other things when I was a child. There clearly is a role for vaccines. That's not the point. And, of course, people who are saying, well, you don't want any vaccines at all, well, that's a misrepresentation. The misuse of vaccines is clearly a major issue. And, of course, what Robert Kennedy has uncovered and is the fact that they've been carrying out all sorts of unethical vaccination programs in the developing world, which have caused massive damage.
The other side of this is that there's vast amounts of money now being made introducing new mandatory vaccines.
Well, indeed, yes. So we can see. So you've got the genuine use of vaccines have been used, for example, in China and in the Soviet Union when they didn't have private pharmaceutical companies. They may have been vaccinating people wrongly. They may have been vaccinating people rightly, but it wasn't being driven by the kind of agenda behind the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I mean, the idea that Gates is some kind of philanthropist is laughable. I mean, basically, his philanthropy leads to massive profits for the companies invested in. So there's a clear conflict of interest there. I mean, as similar to the conflict of interest, to be fair, in the first hour, of the person who wants airlines to fly because he happens to work in the airline industry and he's losing money. I mean, conflicts of interest are everywhere.
Well, actually, to be fair to him, he's saying he believes that the SAGE minutes should be made public so that the arguments behind the decisions can then be scrutinised.
Fair enough. But at the same time, it's conflict of interest is inherent, potentially, in any decision about anything.
And also, of course, political parties all get paid. In fact, individual specific politicians also get paid.
Indeed.
By lobbyists, and those lobbyists expect to get the laws enforced that they want.
Absolutely. And of course, that is the real world we live in. Now, you can try and find ways to make sure, you know, for example, the most simple way is to make sure that everybody has to say what their interests are. But of course, they can lie. And of course, you could also just say, well, you know, for example, you can't be a politician and or political parties in Scandinavia are funded by the government so that nobody can lobby them to offer them money because they can't give it to them anyway. And that's what they brought in the aftermath of World War II. In Britain, we've always had a, you know, the wealthy run the country attitude and the poor just have to put up with what they put up with. You get the voice you get. In the US, it's even further down the road of money controlling politics because corporations are treated as if they are individuals by the Supreme Court decisions of some years ago. I mean, all of these conflicts of interest are there at the best of times. And in a crisis, of course, it becomes very important to understand who's saying what and why.
OK, so now we're going to look at Prince Charles. Prince Charles is planning to overturn hundreds of years of tradition. No wonder he's put so much time and money into public relations. So he keeps seeing his face on TV and the radio and all over the media, as well as, some might argue, ensuring all voices which might ruffle a smooth transition to him becoming king are discredited or silenced. But will it actually happen in April 2021? He seems to think it will. The palace has put out denials as to whether it will happen or not. Princes Andrew and Harry, of course, have been rather spun out of the situation in different ways, kind of character assassinated, so that they seem to be less credible if this all comes to a head next year. But let's have a listen now to a clip here from one of the most recent. I mean, we've been booted off the radio here in Bristol, off FM, hoping to be back on FM next week, but in another different station. But Prince Charles on Classic FM, he's been appearing there. So let's have a listen to an extract from that now.
The final movement of the first horn concerto by young Richard Strauss, played by the brilliant Dennis Brain, with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Alceo Gallieri. As I was saying, I'm patron of the Philharmonia Orchestra and its chorus. In fact, I'm also patron of 12 orchestras, opera companies and choirs. President or patron of the Royal Ballet, the Birmingham Royal Ballet and the Royal Ballet School, as well as the Royal College of Music, the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama, and patron of the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. I became involved with these eminent institutions because I consider music education to be of the greatest importance. It can make a profound difference to young people's lives, offering them all sorts of skills that are useful beyond the world of music. It teaches self-discipline, it can help strengthen people's self-esteem, and it can open up all kinds of doors onto history. One personal benefit of having this association is that musicians offer me recommendations. For instance, some years ago, I was given this next CD. It's music by Sir Julius Benedict, whom I confess I'd never heard of before. I discovered he had a long association in the 19th century with the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra, the oldest professional orchestra in the country. Benedict was born in Stuttgart He was taught by two great composers of the 19th century, Karl Maria von Weber and Johann Nepomuk Hummel, who had a particular influence on him. And then he came to Britain in 1835 and spent the rest of his life here. I then discovered that he wrote a wedding march for my great-great-grandfather, the then Prince of Wales, who became King Edward VII. But I was transfixed by Benedict's second piano concerto, and this is the first movement.
So we can't quite compete with the all of the boasting there of Prince Charles about all these amazing orchestras that he's president of or patron of. And maybe this show isn't quite as ponderous, but Martin, this is the sort of thing that we've been replaced with on the National, on Classic FM. It does seem as if he's a vast patron of the arts. The only trouble is, of course, that music in our schools has gone down the tubes. There's hardly any music now being taught in secondary schools, and there's been massive budget cuts to it.
Well, that's right. So in other words, he's basically being given a platform on Classic FM to talk to the Classic FM audience about how wonderfully classical music is and how wonderful it is for young people to be involved in it, when, of course, in the last 30 years, it's been rooted out of schools by the national curriculum and by no funding.
And I wonder how many Classic FM listeners are going to have to be putting their masks on public transport. Not too many, I would imagine. Also, he's been talking today, I don't have a clip from that, about COVID-19, but he's also been getting behind, Prince Charles has been getting behind the Pick for Britain campaign, which I suppose is really about the lack of migrant workers. He's saying, well, we're not going to be putting the wages up, but we think that unemployed British people should go and pick this stuff instead.
Well, it's typical of it. Can I speak?
Yeah.
It's typical of his out of touch mentality, isn't it?
Well, let's have a listen to Prince Charles now. Picking for Britain.
At this time of great uncertainty, many of our normal routines and regular patterns of life are being challenged. The food and farming sector is no exception. If we are to harvest British fruit and vegetables this year, we need an army of people to help. Food does not happen by magic. It all begins with our remarkable farmers and growers. If the last few weeks have proved anything, it is that food is precious and valued, and it cannot be taken for granted. This is why that great movement of the Second World War, the Land Army, is being rediscovered in the newly created Pick for Britain campaign. In the coming months, many thousands of people will be needed to bring in the crops. It will be hard graft, but is hugely important if we are to avoid the growing crops going to waste. Harvesting runs until early autumn, and people are needed who are genuinely going to commit. The phrase I've often heard is pickers who are stickers. Now, I do not doubt that the work will be unglamorous and at times challenging, but it is of the utmost importance, and at the height of this global pandemic, you will be making a vital contribution to the national effort. So I can only urge you to pick for Britain.
Martin, no mention of the wages there.
No. Well, of course, in actual fact, this campaign, such as it is, has not got very far, because the people who normally come from Eastern Europe to pick obviously can't come because of the lockdown. And it doesn't make a lot of sense for British people who have responded to this and said, well, we're prepared to go pick stuff. Well, they say, first of all, you've got to move to where the crops are. You can't just live in your own house. You've got to go where it is. And that means you've got to leave home. You've got to commit to doing the whole crop. You can't just say, I want to do one day a week or something like that. And of course, it means that you then lose potentially access to things like universal credit and so on. And in actual fact, for most people in this country, it doesn't make much sense. The whole soft fruit industry, which has developed in Herefordshire, where my parents live, is dependent, really. It only grew up after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fact that people would come from Eastern Europe to pick the stuff. And if that hadn't happened, it would never have developed. And it may well be that these companies are ultimately unviable in a post-COVID world. So coming back to the economics of all of the COVID business, is the world economy is going to go through a massive crisis now. So the presumption that businesses which existed before this crisis are going to come out of it on the other side is just that, a presumption. It may well be that the soft fruit industry in Britain is finished because the nature of the beast has changed.
Anyway, so we're going to look now at Prince Charles's suitability to take over as Prince Regent. And I ought to make it clear, but last October, there was a load of press reports coming out saying that the Queen was not going to abdicate. She was going to retire and that when she became 95, because that's exactly what happened with Prince Philip. He retired from royal duties when he was 95, and that Prince Charles was going to arrive and come in as what they call Prince Regent. The palace has strenuously denied this, but of course, this, if it's a genuine leak, they would be expected to deny it. They do that sort of thing all the time. So it doesn't mean to say it's not going to happen. It may do. The idea was it was supposed to be a complete surprise, but maybe it won't be. We shall see. But the key thing here really is that if Prince Charles is going to take over the Church of England whilst not being a Christian himself and bringing about this kind of multi-faith idea, that we need to be quite closely scrutinizing, you know, is he the right guy for the job? Is he showing a very good moral character himself? So let's have a listen now to something from 2011, and it's a trailer for the film which the royals attempted to ban, but someone from here in Bristol actually got the film out over a long weekend all over the world before the lawyers woke up on Monday morning. And so it got distributed all over the world. And it's the film is called Unlawful Killing, and that is the result of the inquest. So clearly the idea here is that Diana was murdered. And the director of the film is Keith Allen, who I don't know if he's ever worked since he made the film, but a terrific film it is. And I'll put a link up on our show page to it. But let's have a listen to the trailer for that film now with Keith Allen.
In 1997, the death of a princess and her lover rocked the world. 10 years later, it led to the longest, most expensive and most sensational inquest in British legal history. Hundreds of witnesses were called. There were arguments, lies, tears and accusations, as intimate details of their private lives were dissected on the world stage. Yet before the court case had even begun, the media had already decided what the verdict should be. However, in Britain and around the world, millions of ordinary people were convinced, and after the inquest still are convinced, that the deaths of Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed were no accident.
I think it's murder.
Murder.
My own opinion, there can be no doubt that she was actually murdered.
When the woman left a note saying, FYI, if I'm dead, here's how it's going to happen, and then it happens exactly like that, I think someone should pay attention.
I mean, I just know our initial reaction was, well, they finally killed her, because we're used to it.
I think it would be murder.
If you go to a bar, you'll find three people go, ooh, but the royals did it, didn't they?
Oh, of course Diana was bumped off. She knew she was going to be bumped off.
I wasn't sure if Diana's death was an accident or murder, but I suspected a cover-up by the British establishment, an elaborate exercise in burying the truth rather than uncovering it. I suspected a conspiracy, but this isn't just the old story about a conspiracy before the crash, it's about a conspiracy after the crash.
We all know that the biggest scandals are always the cover-ups. It isn't the Watergate, it's not the break-in, it's the cover-up which is the big scandal.
When you have the head of the British Security Services calmly announcing we have never killed anybody in the last 50 years, I laughed out loud. What's the point of them then? I didn't believe it. And so if you don't believe that, where does that leave the rest of the establishment evidence?
I decided to watch and wait, then tell the story that the press and TV news wouldn't tell. The result is a documentary that reveals what really happened during those 6 months in the Royal Courts of Justice. The inquest was held in the royal family's own court, so is it any wonder that the coroner, the royal representative in charge, decided that the key royal suspects need not even appear at the inquest to be questioned?
Well, no, it's not. And of course, there were several coroners that were appointed but then resigned before one was finally found to take that. And the verdict, Martin, was unlawful killing. So that suggests murder.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, there's a whole literature and plenty of people have been investigating this for many, many years.
So let's have a listen now to another person who's been doing that. His name is John Morgan. He's dead now, but he's done several books about this, and he looked very, very closely. He was also given some very interesting leaked material. His main sources for the books were the inquest we just heard about there, the transcripts from that, also the British police investigation and the French police investigation. So let's have a listen to John Morgan now. Here he talks about something called the Way Ahead Group. And this is actually some of this is the group that he believes was actually of a private secretaries, which was behind the decision that Diana had to die.
I was just talking about the Way Ahead Group, which is the royal family's committee that deals with major policy and issues facing the royal family. And we were talking about in July 1997... how the Way Ahead Group meeting was brought forward. And what happened was, when you look at the dates of what occurred, where Diana took the two boys away on the holiday to Mohammed's Villa in the south of France, and you look at the dates of the Way Ahead Group meetings, there was actually a preparatory meeting held on July the 8th, which is another reason why you would see the purpose of Way Ahead Group meetings as being much more than just dealing with scheduling, which is what the private secretary said, because if you have a preparatory meeting, then you have a full meeting later, and which is what happened in July 1997. So if there was just dealing with scheduling, it would be dealt with by the private secretaries. You wouldn't have the Queen and Philip and that being there in the meetings. You would have the private secretaries discussing things, going back to their principals and working it out between themselves. So anyway, that's by the by. But what they did is, on the July the 8th, 1997, there was a preparatory meeting of the Way Ahead Group, and that was 3 days before Diana took the boys on the holiday. So the holiday started on July the 11th, and then the holiday finished on July the 20th, and then the Way Ahead Group meeting occurred on July the 23rd. The main full meeting occurred on July the 23rd, which was 3 days after the boys were back at, this is up at Balmoral, where the royals go for holidays at that time of the year. So the boys were returned to Balmoral on July the 20th, and the Way Ahead Group meeting took place on July the 23rd. It's interesting because on July the 20th, there was an article in, I think it was a Sunday Mirror in the UK, where they were talking about the upcoming Way Ahead Group meeting, and they said Diana will be top of the agenda. So there was a leak to the media from someone in the royal household that told this reporter that Diana would be top of the agenda. But it basically ties in with the holiday that she took the boys on, which would have been a huge issue for the royals, taking the future king to Mohammed's Villa in the south of France. Diana wasn't invited to any of these meetings because Diana was outside of the royal family at the stage. After the divorce in August 96, Diana was removed from the royal family. So she was a free spirit, if you know what I mean. She wasn't part of the Way Ahead Group meetings. I think even from 1992, I doubt Diana was in any Way Ahead Group meetings. Once the separation had taken place, and also once she had gone public with that book 6 months before the separation, she was a rebel. She was a rebel. She was an independent person, and she was speaking her mind sort of publicly. Well, that didn't go down well, and basically the Queen didn't want to have much to do with her after that. But when you get back to this Way Ahead Group meeting, it took place The preparatory meeting took place 3 days before the holiday, and then the actual full meeting took place 3 days after the holiday. So the boys were back, the holiday was over, they could assess what had occurred, you know, and assess the media reaction. There was a lot of media criticism of Diana taking the boys to Mohammed's. That was a huge issue at the time in the media in the UK. And Diana was outside of the Queen's control at that stage. And up until the divorce, the Queen had been able to legally deal with Diana if she did anything. But once the divorce was settled, she was outside the royal family, there was no longer any legal avenue for the Queen. She couldn't control Diana. She was free to do, once she was divorce was over, she was free to act as a citizen, you know. And
do you think that the Queen might have some kind of, you know how some people, they are very nice and friendly and lovely and what have you, but if you cross them, disobey them, or subvert their will, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, well, that's right. And she would be like, see, it's sort of, when you think about it, she's in a very unique position because she's actually a very powerful woman. Like every week she meets with the Prime Minister, you know, of the UK, and they don't talk about the weather. They're talking about what's going on, you know, and that's every week. So, and even if the Prime Minister's out of the country or the Queen's out of the country, the Prime Minister has to ring her. So there's that contact. Every Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. there's that contact between the Queen and the head of the UK political system, the Prime Minister. And so she's a very powerful woman.
Martin, I know you think the monarchy's actually really more ceremonial, but John Morgan saying there that he thinks actually the Queen or whoever is fulfilling that role, maybe Charles from next April, is actually far more powerful than we realise.
Well, they clearly are powerful. There is a ceremonial function, obviously. I mean, but the British Constitution is basically a made-up fiction, various accidents of history. I'm personally in favour of constitutional reform. Changing the electoral system, changing the way we run things, probably devolution, and so on. But the monarchy is part of the history of the country, and other countries have monarchies as well. We're not the only one, and they clearly are imbricated with political power. They have been for hundreds of years, so it wouldn't be a surprise, would it?
What about Saudi Arabia? I mean, they've had all sorts of trouble there with the whole succession of the royal family in Saudi, haven't they?
Well, they have. I mean, that is a monarchy. It's a different kind of monarchy from the one that we have in Britain. And of course, the problem with all of these systems is that the system in Saudi Arabia is basically set up by the British in collaboration with various powerful families, the Al Saud family. And it's not a modern society, is it? Run upon rational principles.
Not really. Anyways, John Morgan, we just heard from. We're going to hear a final clip from him in a second, a much shorter one. But his books are Paris-London Connection, The Assassination of Princess Diana, and How They Murdered Princess Diana. Various correspondents keep saying this is the one you've got to get, The Shocking Truth by John Morgan, which is available for around about £10 online. I think it's from the Alibris website. These things definitely worth a look, but let's get back to the community. This is what Morgan deals with in his books, is all the political and the practical implications of who and how Diana was killed. If she was killed, I suppose that's still a question mark, although it does seem like all the evidence is stacking up that she was assassinated, and certainly the unlawful killing verdict suggests that at the inquest. Let's have a listen now to John Morgan talking about some of the anomalies at the crash scene. That is to say, first of all, the Fiat Uno that was also there under the tunnel, which then sort of spirited away and was disappeared. And also Princess Diana's note saying that she believed that her husband was going to have her killed in a car crash.
On September the 17th, the French went public with information about the white Fiat Uno, that it had contact with the Mercedes in the tunnel, and also that they had found pieces of the Fiat Uno in the tunnel, and on the Mercedes that there was paint, white paint from the Uno. So the French were saying, well, the driver hasn't come forward. So there you've got a situation where there's another party involved there that hadn't come forward, and obviously that raises the possibility of suspicion. And so the next day on the 18th, Victor Mishcon came into the police with the note about that Diana was predicting that she could die in a car crash, and Paul Condon, the commissioner of police, basically locked that note up in his safe, in his office safe, and it stayed there for 6 years. So, you know, it's a situation where a person is predicting they die in a car crash, the car crash happens, they do die, and then the police are provided with a piece of evidence saying that the person had predicted the death in a car crash. So it would be natural for the police to investigate it. That's what we'd all expect and hope, if that's what happened to any of us.
Sure.
And yet it happened to Princess Diana, and the note gets locked away, and absolutely no investigation took place regarding that, the information in that note.
So that's John Morgan again there. His book, the really definitive one, I suppose, is How They Murdered Princess Diana, The Shocking Truth, by John Morgan, available for around about £10. Anybody that's into this, I mean, you know, there are some people, many, many people out there that say, oh, yes, Diana was definitely bumped off. But that is explaining how it happened. But, Martin, the big implication here is, obviously, Prince Charles wasn't down there in the tunnel, but, you know, we would almost certainly have had to sign off something like this, as other royals would, because otherwise there could be fallout. If they didn't know that something like this was going to happen, that Diana was going to be dispatched, then it could all come back to haunt whoever did it.
Well, I think that you're jumping two steps ahead there. The first question is, was she murdered? Which, as you say, could easily be answered yes. Although, again, we've got to keep an open mind. Secondly, did Prince Charles order it? Now, that's another matter. It may be that she had enemies that weren't Prince Charles that wanted her dead. And you've got to think about that as well. I think it's easy to say that because things are covered up, there's a conspiracy.
Well, I mean, the way these sorts of things work is that it's a sort of a nod and a wink, isn't it? That various suggestions are made, and there is a nod and a wink goes backwards and forwards. And the idea really here, though, is you have to make sure that if something like this does take place, an assassination of such a high level, then those who might pursue an investigation, I suppose this is rather like the 9/11 attacks or something, those, for example, with Mueller at the top of the FBI, that you need to know. And of course, the Kennedy assassination is another one where the heads of the main agencies who would be in charge of investigating it have to know that nobody is going to be pursuing this after the event.
Well, I mean, what you're saying is that conspiracies have to be conspiratorial, which is a truism. Of course they do. Any conspiracy has to be activated. And, of course, the problem is that you've got to prove all these things one way or another. And, of course, there's often a motivation not to investigate, especially, you know, when there's a lot at stake.
Well, you're coming to the big one now, and that is, of course, that whoever is actually the head of state is the one person who is above the law.
Yeah, but that presumes that you're just dealing in ideal terms. The Queen is a powerful person, but she's not the head of the CIA. She's a Queen of England. She will have there are powerful forces out there where we possibly don't even know the names of the people.
But the Queen is the one who appoints judges. She appoints military and intelligence officials at the top, very top levels. I mean, although they're recommended by committees, you know, it's made sure that whoever's on those committees is not going to recommend somebody that the Queen wouldn't like. Also, she's got this network of Lord Lieutenants, she is one of the only people actually scrutinises people like our very own local mafia. They called the Bristol Mafia, colloquially, the Merchant Venturers. So there is quite a lot of power in there. Anyway, I'd like to look, if you don't mind, at some of the other strange and some criminal associations of Prince Charles. First of all, it's the bizarre court case that took place in 2002 with Diana's valet, who's Paul Burrell, where there was a court case against him, which what stopped right in the middle of it when the Queen remembered a conversation that she'd had with him. Now, this is all to do with something called Diana's mahogany box, something that she called her crown jewels, which was a whole load of tapes, recorded information about Prince Charles, which potentially could have been copied and could possibly come out. And because it was well known that Diana passed these to people, including Burrell, who she trusted to make sure that this information came out if Prince Charles was to ever take over the throne. So, Martin, what do you make of that? The mahogany box full of information on Charles that Paul Burrell had. And why was the court case stopped halfway through?
Well, it's possible because he's implicated, but it's only a possibility. As we know, what was probably going to happen, he's going to take over as king at some point.
Well, let's focus on the court case, please, this Paul Burrell court case, because what would probably have happened there is much of this evidence would have actually come out during the court case. So I would imagine that the Paul Burrell had a word with somebody who had a word with the Queen, and she said, I think we should close this court case down right now because I don't want this evidence about this mahogany box and what might have been or might not have been in it coming out in open court.
Well, you can imagine that they wouldn't. No doubt he has got some skeletons in the cupboard. Some of them are probably fairly obvious. I mean, his political views are fairly clear. But, you know, you can't just presume anything, Tony, about anything, can you?
Well, I'm certainly not presuming. What I am, I suppose, presuming here is that there has been a deliberate attempt there to make sure that this evidence didn't come out in court. Foremost amongst the concerns was that the details of a rape allegation contained in an explosive tape recording made by Princess Diana would be publicly aired at the Old Bailey. Well, that would have been a bit embarrassing, wouldn't it?
Well, it would. I mean, and of course, Prince Andrew, as we know, was a colleague of Epstein, as was Gates, Clinton, Trump, and Epstein was probably working for Mossad and blackmailing all of them.
Okay, well, also,
Mossad have got stuff on the British royal family.
Looking at another scandal that Charles has been involved with, I mean, obviously as a very active, busy member of civic society, he's bound to be embroiled in some, but there's just so many. Abuse survivors sent from the UK to Australia as children have been given fresh hope of redress from the Prince's Trust. This is a story just last month, actually, May 2020. The charity says it's provided funds to compensate those sent to Australia by the Fairbridge Society, which Prince Charles was running or was a patron of anyway, many of whom suffered physical and sexual abuse when they were sent over in the 1970s over to Australia. An estimated 2,500 child migrants were sent to most Australian states by the Fairbridge Society. They and something like 2,500 of them were sexually abused as well as regularly beaten.
Well, I mean, that's another scandal, isn't it? And if you think about it, as you say, he's basically involved in all of these kind of organisations, and therefore you could say that he's behind all of it. I would suggest that that's probably an exaggeration.
Well, let's see what else. I mean, no, I don't
these
think
organisations
we can,
are not very
of these
good organisations.
Can be pinned on Prince Charles, I don't think necessarily. But it's interesting to see how many scandals surround him. The Mystery Royal was part of a suspected paedophile ring being investigated by Scotland Yard. This is back in the 1980s, but the inquiry was shut down for national security reasons. So this is the sort of power that the royals have in order to just stop proper criminal investigations into their affairs. Then there's the lonely death of Kanga Tyron. She was Charles's other mistress from Australia. She died in mysterious circumstances on 15th of November 1997 of a horrible illness in hospital. Then, of course, there was Charles and Camilla's 2005 marriage, which the lawyers at the time said was illegal under the 1836 Marriage Act, Martin, because the royal if there's a royal culprit in a divorce case, they cannot legally remarry. And yet Charles got married anyway. I suppose that's just nowadays we would think, well, these old things like the 1836 Marriage Act aren't really valid anymore. But it was actually an act in Parliament that hadn't been thrown out, but they got married anyway.
Well, yes, I mean, there's all sorts of anomalies about the way Britain is run. it's officially a democracy, except it isn't officially a democracy. It's officially a monarchy. I will say this. The Crown is the way in which the intelligence services and the deep state operate in this country. The Crown become, for example, the military and the police and all the rest of it do not swear allegiance to a constitution because we haven't got one. They swear allegiance to the Crown. And therefore, the Crown is above the parliamentary and political process.
Okay, so
that is an anomaly.
Yeah, you're right.
It was an anomaly that was ended in Ireland in 1920.
Hooray. About time. Anyway, March 2008, police bodyguard Richard Fuller was found inexplicably dead at Camilla's home. And also, why did the husband of the prince's personal florist kill himself? A mystery as the body is found at sea. Now, this was in 2009. The husband of Prince Charles's personal flower arranger was found dead amidst reports that their marriage was falling apart. Friends claim that David Lowe, though, would not have committed suicide. That's another one. This is all associated with Highgrove in Gloucestershire, where Prince Charles lives. And then also a reporter who exposed the BBC paedophile cover-up was found dead. This is a woman actually I work with at Radio Solent, Liz McKean, former British investigative reporter, exposed the Jimmy Savile affair and obviously links to Prince Charles. Savile and Charles were very close. The culture of paedophile protection at the BBC has been found dead. She was 52 years of age. That was actually just a couple of years ago. A friendship with Prince Charles has made the paedophile bishop, Peter Ball, impregnable. That's just a headline from this year. There's a BBC Two documentary showing how establishment figures rallied around the cleric, including Prince Charles, who told Peter Ball, the paedophile bishop of Gloucester, in a letter in February 1995, 2 years after the bishop had accepted a police caution, he said, "I wish I could have done more." This is Prince Charles quoted. "I wish I could have done more. I feel so desperately strongly about the monstrous wrongs that have been done to you and the way you have been treated." Well, what about the monstrous wrongs that Peter Ball had been doing to young boys? Charles didn't seem to notice that. Anyway, also a Highgrove tribute was made to a woman who died after falling into a garden well. This is another Highgrove member of staff dead. Irina Nadiotia worked in Prince Charles's garden at Highgrove in Gloucestershire. A woman who fell to her death down a 15-metre well in her garden was a cherished member of the team, Prince of Wales Highgrove Estate. And finally, plots, backstabbing and infighting and goings-on at Highgrove. Prince Charles's secret life revealed in a new book. Tom Bower has written a book called The Rebel Prince, and he labels the royal as petulant. Anyway, Martin, it's quite a litany of apparent crimes and certainly death. I mean, we did a program, didn't we, a few years ago called Death and Lies at the Cotswold Water Park, which, of course, is very close to Highgrove as well. So it doesn't seem as if Prince Charles is the very, very good omens around whether he's trustworthy and whether we can be sure that he will be a very good either upholder of the faith or of the law, because effectively, as the person in charge of the criminal law system, he would be needed to be seen to be well above the law to take it over if that happens in April 2021.
Well, there's a number of things there, isn't there? Should we have a monarchy at all? Good question. Very good question. Secondly, should he be it? Another good question. Maybe there are questions about whether he should be it. The third question about whether he should be head of the Church of England. Well, maybe the Church of England should be disestablished. We need a constitutional revolution in this country where we don't have an established church. We don't have a monarchy, probably. We change the electoral system so that we wouldn't end up with a majority of 80 about to destroy the country, even though a majority voted against them. That is those are the more fundamental questions to my mind than the personal foibles of him. Although if he's guilty of any of the things that you've alleged, then of course he should be.
Well, these are not allegations. These are facts of people who've died up at Highgrove. And of course, the most important really is of his ex-partner, Kanga from Australia, and the apparent murder of Princess Diana, his former wife.
Well, that's right. So in other words, we've got a nested set of questions there. Should we have a monarchy at all? Should we have an established national religion at all? And thirdly, is he a murderer? if he is a murderer, he should be prosecuted.
Well, I mean, maybe you don't think necessarily he himself, but I mean, he may have been part of a conspiracy, possibly. Well, we shall see. Anyway, Martin, the main point here is there is talk about skipping a generation. So the idea that when the Queen does finally retire, that actually Prince Charles is missed out and the monarchy goes straight to Prince William.
Well, that may happen. We'll have to wait and see. Well, I come back to my first point. Do we want a monarchy at all?
What would be the alternative?
Well, in Ireland, they have a president, which doesn't have very much power. It's a ceremonial president, and it works reasonably well. They certainly don't have loads and loads of hangers-on, which you've got with a royal family, because it's not just the Queen. There's a whole load of other people who are paid to be.
So who would you see as a potential president of Britain then?
Well, what you've got in Ireland is the president tends to be somebody. They're elected, but they haven't got a great deal of power. They're basically a ceremonial president. And it tends to be people who've already been in politics or have got some kind of past in politics. So the current guy, whose name now escapes me, he was basically an author. He was a writer, and he ended up being the president. And it works quite well for them. No big deal. It's not like the president of the United States. They don't do anything much. They just represent the country.
And he sounds like the sort of non-executive director that you get on the boards of companies like Shell. You know, these people who are seen as sort of nice people, but actually they're easily controlled for one reason or another.
Well, no, but the point is that you've got to have some kind of system. You don't have to have a president at all. I mean, in New Zealand, you have a unicameral parliament. And of course, they still got the Queen, but they could easily get rid of the Queen and the unicameral parliament would carry on ruling. And
well, I think
it might become head of state by default.
It might be more difficult in countries like Australia or whatever to get rid of the Queen, and not New Zealand, to get rid of the Queen than you might think. Finally, from December 1994, let's see what Spike Milligan had to say when he received an award for a lifetime achievement of comedy and had Prince Charles, even though he didn't attend the ceremony, BAFTA, he actually sent a message which was read out by Jonathan Ross.
Here we go, I have a letter to read out here from His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales. I must confess that I've been a lifelong fan of Spike Milligan.
Oh, the little grovelling bastard.
He just seemed to say whatever was on his mind, but you didn't ever know what you were going to get.
As TV companies have not employed me for 10 years. I will take that as a golden handshake.
Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour. That's community journalist for the Lancashire Telegraph, Henry Widdus. And download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing, enjoyable BCFM weekend. You can hear Danny Loch Sunday evening at 7 o'clock. BCFM boss Pat Hart did say our sister show Dialect would be on BCFM every Monday at 10 p.m, but so far it hasn't appeared. And we'll be back on FM soon, Pat Hart willing. Do please join us for the politics show live stream at the old time of 5 o'clock start next Friday, and we'll do our very best to actually have a live stream, proper live stream, and possibly even be going out on FM somewhere next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.